country is in a grip of a devastating second wave of the virus. Many unforeseen issues are cropping up and severely hampering the country's fight against the virus. Health experts believe the country's health system is on the verge of collapse, blaming the government's unpreparedness and failed policies for the country's failure to tackle the second wave. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
No one eats or drinks anything during the day. Restaurants and bakeries are all closed. This is not neither because of threats or the COVID-19 pandemic. What has created such an atmosphere across Afghanistan comes from a religious belief that prohibits Muslims from drinking and eating under the name of fasting. Ramadan is the name for one of the holiest Islamic months and is the ninth month in the Islamic lunar calendar. The rising of the sun marks the beginning of fasting and Muslims are allowed to break it after sunset. Now let's see how Afghans break their fasts when the sun sets. The approval for every Muslim to break their fast is Azan-e-Maghrib, or the call for the sunset prayer. That is why almost all Muslims first do their sunset prayers before breaking their fast, which is called iftar. However, iftar time is a specific time for Afghans, as they traditionally and religiously get together at their homes or at restaurants. The gatherings are called iftari. There are special dishes and drinks in the Afghan food culture for iftari.
Iftar time is very important to our people. We prepare some special dishes and drinks for iftar, such as duk, tea, fresh juices, and some local dishes, including bolani, sambasa, ashak, manto, qabili, and kebab.
Many here also see the fasting month of Ramadan as a time for boosting their family relations and social ties by inviting others for iftari.
We have many traditions and customs to mark the holy month of Ramadan. For instance, most of us use Ramadan as an opportunity to invite others for iftari. This is based on our religious and traditional beliefs that, of course, strengthen our social ties.
In the meantime, there are also poor people who are in urgent need of food and shelter during the holy month of Ramadan. Our religion teachings urge Muslims to support them as part of duties of a fasting Muslim. Therefore, some individuals and charity groups set up food distribution programs for poor families during the holy month. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
COVID-1 vaccine was proved safe during the first phase of the human trials. And now the second stage suggests it also provides effective immunity against the coronavirus. Produced by the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, COVID-1 was injected to 280 volunteers in the second clinical stage. And the results were reported to the health ministry.
We passed the first and second clinical stages, and in the next 2 days, we will report the results of the second phase to the regulatory bodies. So far, we have achieved promising results as to the efficiency of the vaccine. Once this phase is complete, we can then speak with certainty about the exact percentage of the vaccine's efficiency.
Once the second phase is over and the vaccine is proved effective against the coronavirus, the third and final stage will then be initiated, which involves giving the jabs to 20,000 volunteers. COVID-1 authorities say they have already issued the call for voluntary injections since time is running short.
Based on international standards, if a vaccine gives at least 50% immunity against the virus, it is viable and can be mass-produced. We are confident from our lab tests that Coviran is effective and can generate significant number of antibodies, so we have already issued a call for volunteers to study its efficacy on a larger statistical population.
The first phase of the clinical trial was carried out in December last year, which proved that the vaccine is safe and will not cause any side effects. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, including Covpars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
Coviran is already ahead in the race compared to other Iranian local vaccines. Now as the fourth wave of the pandemic is sweeping the country, Coviran developers say they're making their utmost efforts to get their jabs to the market. within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Two working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the US. Now a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, the important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in dispute over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington think as a threat to its global interests.
Northern Ireland is bracing itself for more potential trouble. peaceful pop-up protests across the region in the coming days, an opportunity, some say, to catch police by surprise and block major roads for a time. They follow days of riots and violent clashes earlier this month that plunged the city of Belfast and parts of Northern Ireland into a crisis not seen since the dark days of the Troubles that started in the late 1960s and led to nearly three decades of bloodshed.
There will be protests around the north of Ireland, but what's worrying is that there's a lot of disinformation also. What we're seeing here is a hidden hand and trying to raise tensions between the Catholic and Protestant communities. And when we see this, these things happening, we always have to remember that when there's a void there, extremists fill that void. And when the extremists are there to fill that void, we always see the hidden hand of British security services.
Tensions have been rising since Brexit, which many warn would threaten the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 that put an end to the Troubles. The implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol allowed the UK to leave the EU without setting up a border on the island of Ireland. Instead, the UK and EU agreed to a customs border between Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, the loyalist and unionist communities who wish to remain under British rule are demanding the protocol be scrapped.
This would seriously destabilize the peace and brought us back to somewhere that was pre-1998 and something that we as a society didn't want to see.
The riots were also fueled by the country's police chief's refusal to resign after a decision not to prosecute Sinn Féin politicians for attending a large funeral last year against COVID restrictions.
I don't see why Simon Byrne would have resigned. I think that he gave his report to those that would have made that decision within the PPS. And, you know, it, once he has passed that on, there's not much he can do after that. He made recommendations.
Efforts are underway for a political settlement of tensions, including a call for dialogue among all sides from the U.S. president. Still, fears of more unrest and violence are in the air. Saeed Bouriza, London.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, updated the bloc's 27 foreign affairs ministers on the latest state of play regarding talks in Vienna to try and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding U.S. sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. Only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interests and the Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The debate.
Head of U.S. Central Command Kenneth McKenzie says Iran possesses one of the most capable militaries in the Middle East. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region. McKenzie, who testified before the U.S. House Armed Services Committee, said Iran's widespread use of drones means that the U.S. is operating without complete air superiority for the first time since the Korean War. Iran has time and again stated that its military capabilities are merely defensive and are designed to deter foreign threats. Our correspondent Colin Campbell joins us now from Washington. Tell us more about the testimony that was made before the U.S. House Armed Services Committee by CENTCOM Commander Kenneth McKenzie. Colin?
Are created through lots of intel and research from the interactions that have happened prior. What they're looking at, in addition to the report that released the testimony, is Operation Praying Mantis, if we remember back in 1988, when there was an exchange between the U.S. Navy and Iran ships, where several sailors were killed in the exchange. What military commanders and leadership is looking to increase in the amount of the weaponry that could have improved from 30 years ago. And this, of course, would increase the casualties of these sailors who are involved in any conflict. The U.S. is loath to engage in conflict with Iran because they know that with the advance of technology, the use of mines, and the improvement of weaponry, such an exchange could be very deadly. And that's part of the testimony that you heard, trying to emphasize that a more diplomatic resolution would be desirable rather than something that would involve the U.S. or the Iranian military.
All right, thanks a lot. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington. Joining us on this debate, we have former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, Mr. Scott Ritter, who's joining us from Bethlehem, New York. Mr. Ritter, welcome to the program. What do you make of this acknowledgement?
It's a statement of reality. The fact of the matter is, what McKenzie testified to is something that the Pentagon has been saying in private to the executive branch, whether it was Donald Trump prior or Joe Biden today. If you recall when the Iranians shot down an American drone, Donald Trump was talking about striking Iran with a retaliatory strike. And the Pentagon briefed him on what the consequences of such a strike would be, saying that, look, if you want a war with Iran, we can fight and we can win a war with Iran, but it'll take us 6 to 8 months to build up the military force necessary to achieve that victory. In the meantime, Iran will be striking us regionally with everything they got, and they got a lot, and it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt bad, not just us, but our allies in the region. And, you know, apparently that briefing was enough to get Donald Trump to say, we're not going to attack. And Joe Biden has been given the same briefing.
Now we also have expert of international relations, Mehrdad Torabi, who's joining us now from Bologna. Mr. Torabi, welcome to the program. Do you think that this statement is pointing to the waning influence of the U.S. In the region? An analyst that we spoke to said this shows Washington is facing limitations in the region.
I say hello to you. It's a pleasure being in your program. I think this is, U.S. Central Command is absolutely right. In fact, Iran, I think, is, if not the most, is one of the most capable militaries in Western Asia. But I should say military force goes beyond, really goes beyond what is usually demonstrated. I mean, contrary for strategic reasons, they do not always reveal or disclose all the power, all the means they may have in their possession. And so I think Iran's military power is much, much more powerful than what is demonstrated, what is seen, what is perceived, and what is calculated. That's one point. I want to mention another point, and that is at the tactical level, Iran, well, we know, has a great army of modern drones. It has short and mid-range ballistic missiles, which are precise. At the strategic level, I think Iran, in fact, has entered into space and enjoys a great deal of deterrence by long-range ballistic missiles, which are precise again, all of which are developed domestically, so their technologies are unknown, really, to others. That, again, creates risk and uncertainty and makes outcomes not calculable. The third point, last but not least, I want to mention, I want to talk about moral forces also, because I think they are very important in strategic studies. I think not only Iran strategically and tactically has the upper hand, but also morally has the upper hand in the region. Let me quote Professor Mersheimer. He's an international relation theorist. And we don't have anything to quote him, because if we look around, it's clear to all of us that the United States has been the principal source of murder and mayhem in the region. And so I think the transformation of all of those, you know, liberal ideas of founding fathers in practice into fascism, and this philosophical and moral degeneracy is the moral force behind the legitimacy of resistance. And that is very powerful. And again, it cannot be gauged or calculated or measured. If you look, for instance, to Vietnam example, if you look to Yemen example, we realize how important moral forces are. I want to conclude just very quick. I want to say what I just said is the fact that I should say the United States does not know anything about Islamic Republic's political and military lines.
Okay, we'll get back to you, Mr. Tarby. Let's go back to Mr. Ritter in New York. What about the timing of all this? Talks on reviving the JCPOA are ongoing at the moment. Do you think that there's any significance to the timing of all this?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, I believe the significance is General McKenzie is putting a marker on the table to Congress and anybody who's listening that diplomacy better work. And anybody who thinks that we can give short shrift to diplomacy, that if the talks in Vienna fail and Iran continues to operate outside of the restrictions required by the JCPOA, that there's a military option. I think what General McKenzie is saying is there isn't a military option. Don't look to the military to solve this problem. That it won't be easy, it won't be quick, it won't be cheap, and it probably won't work. So I think that there is great significance to his testimony, and that it, in a way, he's putting pressure on the State Department and Joe Biden himself to stop playing games in Vienna and get this negotiation completed to the satisfaction of all parties, because the option beyond diplomacy, there is no military option, and I think that's what he's trying to say.
Mehrdad Tarabi, the top American general, said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region. Talk to us about that statement. Is that why Washington wants a new deal, a renegotiated JCPOA that includes Iranian missiles?
Well, of course. It's not just Washington, it's Israel. And it's all of Iran's neighbors. The Iranian ballistic missile program has developed in ways that, I don't think military planners imagined 10, 15 years ago. And it was put on display. Iran didn't fire its most capable missiles at the Al-Asad air base, back last year. It fired good missiles with precision capability, but they weren't their best missiles. They were good enough to make the demonstration that when Iran wanted to hit a building with great precision, it could do so. And that had to send a chill down any American military commander whose forces are based in the region, understanding that if this turned into a shooting war, they would pay a heavy price.
Yeah, Scott, that question was actually for Mehrdad, but I'm glad you got your thoughts in as well. Mehrdad, can you give us your thoughts on the same question?
Yes, of course. I totally agree. I think power of this power, this is a power politics. So I don't think Iran will ever set aside its ballistic missile program because in a region that is that we see in international relation term hierarchy, real hierarchy, real anarchy. It is not possible. Countries look for self-reliance and to provide security for themselves. And this is a mean for Iran to achieve that security in the international arena. It will not concluded the ballistic missile program of Iran will not be concluded in any deal.
Scott Ritter, during the Iraqi imposed war on Iran, as stated many times by the foreign minister, the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, U.S. and other Western governments, they armed and they assisted Saddam Hussein with sophisticated weapons while actively preventing Iran from getting access to the most rudimentary defensive necessities. If there's a historical lesson here, it's that Iran must establish a formidable level of defensive military capabilities. Am I right?
There's no doubt about that. Let me make this point very clear. If Iran did not have the ballistic missile capability it possesses today, its nuclear facilities would have already been bombed. It's just that simple. Iran's ballistic missile capability provides a deterrence to this kind of military adventurism, whether it be by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, by Israel, or a combination of the three. The knowledge that any military action against Iran will be met with a retaliation strike by precision-guided missiles capable of striking any point within the region that an attack could be launched from is enough to give pause to the political leaders who would be making the decision to strike Iran. So without these missiles, Iran would have already been attacked. These missiles are the only thing that keeps Iran from being, bombed, and Iran would be literally foolish to give them up.
And stated that its military capabilities are merely defensive and are designed to deter foreign threats with a foreign presence in the region, i.e. the United States, the massive arms sales to the likes of Saudi Arabia, and let's add Israel's destabilizing actions into the mix. Having a sufficient military capability like the one Iran has established right now is a must for Tehran.
Is that to me?
Yeah, we only have you right now.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I didn't want to talk over your guests like
no,
I did
no
in the
problem.
Past.
Go ahead.
Look, the fact of the matter is Iran must have these. The best defense is a good offense. It doesn't mean that you execute the offense. It means you need to be capable of carrying out offensive actions that bring harm to the target. Now, Iran is not saying we want to aggressively, preemptively strike our neighbors. What Iran is saying is that if we are attacked, we will retaliate in kind, and it will hurt. And its ballistic missile capability is that which gives us the authority. And combine that with their drone capability. I mean, very sophisticated, very deadly. I mean, we see evidence of this, on a weekly basis, where Iranian-derived drones and missiles strike Saudi Arabian targets at will. There's nothing the Saudis can do to stop what the Houthis are using. And what Iran possesses are weapons of even greater sophistication and accuracy.
Well, you mentioned the drones, Scott. McKenzie said Iran's drones mean that the U.S. is operating without complete air superiority for the first time since the Korean War. Does the fact that Iran's military know-how is indigenous and domestically manufactured make that sound even more impressive to you?
Well, first of all, it's very impressive. The fact that Iran has done this on its own. I mean, anybody who knows anything about Iran knows that the Iranian people are some of the most educated people in the world. That their scientists are top notch, world quality. And you would be foolish to denigrate them and think that they were incapable of doing these things. But they have weapon systems of great capability, and the fact that these were produced in Iran should give pause to any nation seeking to engage in military conflict with Iran, because the Iranians are demonstrating they are fully capable of defending themselves.
Mehdi Torabi is back with us now from Bologna. We're talking about the issue of sanctions right now, Mehdi. These advancements in the time of the toughest sanctions ever on Iran have led to Iran becoming more and more self-sufficient. Do you think that the whole maximum pressure campaign and the sanctions regime, they've not been successful with regards to the Islamic Republic?
Yes, definitely. I was talking on your question, but connecting to international relations. You know, when we study international relations, we really distinguish between domestic politics and international politics on one important basis. Whoever dictates that, the legitimacy of the monopoly is, of course, which exists in domestic politics, but does not exist in international relations. International relations is actually characterized by anarchy, as I mentioned. Iran was disillusioned by the invasion of Iraq in 1988, Secret Defense. Iran was realized when children are suffocated in their own backyard, there's nobody else out there to get help. Even the United Nations did not condemn the use of weapons of mass destruction. So it was the trigger that started the process of looking inside for self-reliance. I think the process existed, but sanctions and U.S. interventions really strengthened Iran's determination and disillusioned Iran even more, to strengthen Iran's determination to look inside for the self-reliance, for military power. And honestly, I think even sanctions I see in this remark are positive, but of course sanctions in other areas, you know, food and medicine, I see as just a continuation of U.S. notorious history of international.
Scott Ritter, one last question for you before we close out the show. The hawks in Washington, they've been aiming for regime change in a number of countries in the region. The list included Syria. Obviously, they failed in Syria. They had their eye on Iran as well. Do you think they'll now have to reevaluate these ambitions, given Iran's power and position that it has displayed and established in the region?
Not just Iran's power and military position, but I want to talk about
the right to dictate to other nations how they run themselves is unbelievable. But the good news is that these hawks are being pushed out, that realists are starting to come into preeminence. Realists will take guidance from experts like General McKenzie, who caution against the kind of adventurism that the hawks would like to use to achieve their goals of regime change. So while I don't think you're ever going to dissuade those who are vehemently opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran from seeking regime change in that nation, the reality is their influence is waning by the day.
All right, in 30 seconds or less, Mr. Tarabi, you can answer that question as well.
I wanted to see it from another perspective. I wanted to talk about a revolution, which was the revolution of the people for the people. So Iran enjoys a great deal of domestic legitimacy, and it does not need to really purchase security from outside. You know, I just wanted to mention this perspective in 30 seconds.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to my guests, Mr. Mehdad Torabi, expert of international relations, joining us from Bologna. Also thanks to former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, Mr. Scott Ritter, joining us from Bethlehem, New York. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. The problem of U.S. police brutality and violence and the links to white supremacism is hundreds of years old. One officer, like Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, leading to Floyd's death, facing a jail term, will not change the entire system. We now present you an article written by Richard Sedan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, Chauvin is Guilty, but the system is bigger than Chauvin and it must change. News that Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who knelt on the neck of George Floyd, leading to Floyd's death, had been found guilty on all charges, has been welcomed by millions of people. All across the United States and also around the world, the manner in which former police officer Derek Chauvin took the life of George Floyd, while staring brazenly and defiantly into the camera, comfortable in the knowledge that he believed he could get away with murder, outraged almost everyone that saw it. And the fact that Derek Chauvin will now be held accountable for his actions one would hope, would provide some measure of solace to the family of George Floyd, who are still grieving the loss of a loved one whose death sparked mass protests of indignation and fury around the world. Derek Chauvin deserved this day of reckoning and to pay the price for his actions, although it will take several weeks for the judge presiding over the case to announce the sentence for Derek Chauvin. And although many feel Chauvin should have faced a charge of first-degree murder, the family of George Floyd deserve nothing less than seeing Chauvin behind bars for the rest of his life. But it is vital at this stage to remember that justice in one case will not repair a broken system, which in many people's view is working as it was designed and intended to. There is a mode of thinking which persists and which suggests that the problem of unchecked police brutality and violence in the United States can be thought of in terms of a few bad apples, and therefore that dealing with rotten individuals within the police force will fix things. While individuals who commit murder while wearing police uniform must be held accountable, the idea that they are the exception rather than the rule is simply not true. According to the FBI, the institutional corruption and the infiltration of law enforcement from those with white supremacist ideologies is a deep-seated and long-standing problem in the United States. The FBI staff have themselves published several reports on this matter. For those who understand the history of the United States, the scale and depth of the issue is simply the modern chapter of the continued legalized brutality against black communities, beginning since the days of slavery and the inception of the country. The police, of course, have their literal roots in slave-catching gangs. That history has never been accounted for, and the legacy of it continues to this day with deadly consequences. The entire U.S. criminal justice system is riddled with people belonging to white supremacist organizations. We hear about the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, but the reality is that there are countless groups which have those leanings and affiliations. Many believe that part of the reason the United States refuses to designate the Proud Boys as a terrorist group, despite their involvement in the 6th of January Washington riots, which was described as an act of domestic terrorism by the FBI, is because too many current serving police officers would be implicated. The problem of police brutality and violence and the links to white supremacism is hundreds of years old. One police officer like Derek Chauvin facing a jail term will not change the entire system, but it might be purportedly a step in the right direction. Each and every police officer guilty of the kind of violence we saw from Derek Chauvin must face the full force of the law, which of course they themselves are supposed to uphold. If Derek Chauvin is given the sentence he deserves, his case must set a precedent, move forward and deter other police officers from behaving like him. Police officers must be punished for racist killings and murdering with impunity. If they know they face the prospect of jail and will also lose their pensions, they will be deterred from carrying out such acts. It's a question of power and money, the days of police officers knowing that they automatically have the benefit of the doubt, no matter what their behavior, must come to an end. The energy and momentum and public outcry over the case of Derek Chauvin must now be directed towards all cases of police violence and injustice with lethal consequences. Recently, Much was made of George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which many hope will become law. But what is not being talked about so much is the fact that this measure would actually allocate the police hundreds of millions more dollars, in theory, to ensure that they improve policing methods and to bolster their budgets in this regard. But if the police are given more money while being entrusted to police themselves, the move could spell potential disaster. New legislation might come into fruition, but if rules already exist which the police are meant to follow, but they do not follow, what difference will it make? Again, to reiterate, the overarching problem is an issue of the abuse of power, which needs to be punished, because police officers are already breaking the law when they unjustly kill with impunity. But rarely are they charged, and tragically, we have already seen a sobering reminder of the grim reality of things on the very day that Derek Chauvin was found guilty. Approximately half an hour before the verdict of Derek Chauvin was announced, news broke that a 16-year-old teenage black girl named Makia Bryant had been shot dead by a white police officer in Columbus, Ohio. Police say Makia Bryant was carrying a knife when they arrived at the scene, which others say had actually been dropped just moments before she was shot. Makia Bryant was believed to have been carrying the knife due to her involvement in a fight in which she was defending herself and is said to have called the police herself. Critics are arguing that whatever had taken place, the police officers firing several shots killing Bryant was excessive and reflective of a trigger-happy stance which police automatically have towards black people compared to white people, and certainly not how they should have handled this situation. Many are commenting that there was no attempt by the police to de-escalate the situation and that lethal force should have been a last resort. Tragically, it seems it wasn't. The facts of this case are still being established, but if what we are hearing about this case is true, it serves as yet another reminder amid the backdrop of the Derek Chauvin case of just how much work is yet to be done to change the state of affairs regarding violent policing in the United States. African Americans are not safe in the United States with the police operating as they currently do. There are countless cases of black people actually calling the police for help, who then end up dead as a result. Until we see a consistent trend developing of police officers continually being charged and jailed, sending a clear and strong enough message to force a change in the culture of policing, the problem will persist. And where there might seem to be a veneer of change, where in fact there is none, things could even get worse.
Iran, IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.